Hey, Nerd Funnelers, we're back. This is Bob Shway, and you're listening to Nerd Funnel, where we take all the nerd news of the world and funnel it into your more than willing ear holes. With me tonight is Mars.
What's up, Nerd Funnelers?
And we are going to be talking about the aging gamer. We're talking about growing older, how our game tastes have changed, how we select to play informs what's getting made. The game developers are ranging from all ages now. You know, we have people like Kojima and Shigeru Miyamoto, who are, you know, longtime industry veterans making games. Then we have indie developers on Steam that are, you know, barely out of high school doing games and stuff like that. And it ranges all types of experience. We have gamers that are little kids like my nephews that barely know that there was even pixelated graphics, to dudes like us that, you know, grew up playing on the arcade consoles in the 80s. So without further ado, I'd like to kick it to Mars, because Mars had something to say on this topic, and I'm just going to let him run with it.
Well, I thought today's topic was a really, really cool one, because we grew up during the time where video games were really starting to take hold in the U.S. I think the first major console that really dominated in the markets was the old Nintendo Control Deck.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember how, you know, I think I was, 8 years old when I first got mine. This is back in 1988. And I immediately became a fan of games like Legend of Zelda, Super Mario Brothers, the classics, and whatnot. And I was, when you come up from that, in that kind of atmosphere, like you don't know that these games come from Japan, you don't know where they're from, you just play them and you enjoy them.
Yeah.
And as you get a little bit older, like when I got into my teenage years and, you know, the Super Nintendo came out, that we still play games in this very, very innocent, sphere of innocence.
Mm-hmm.
I'm laughing right now because I still remember the first time I realized, well, whoa, we're not in Kansas anymore. And
what was that? Let me guess. Final Fantasy VII?
Yeah,
dude, that's like the crux. The first time you see Cloud going down that train on Midgar, and it was a polygonal, like it was a game changer. Yeah. I had that similarly a little bit too with Final Fantasy VII, but also with Super Mario 64. Like when the Nintendo 64 came out, so Super Mario 64, yeah. And then of course Legend of Zelda: Ocarina of Time. But let me ask you this: so you said you like grew up playing the classics, right? So you go back and you play Mario, the original Mario, you play. And, so you go back, do you get the same level of enjoyment? Do you enjoy it on the same level? Do you, like, I'll tell you this right now, Manny and I, we go back and we play Super Mario, the original, and then Super Mario 3, and we have just as much fun as we did before and when we were little kids as we do now.
I haven't really tried that, actually. Several of the old school games are available on, say, on the Apple iOS, like Dragon Warrior, but they're not pixelated. They're coming with updated graphics.
Well, a lot of the original graphic ones are available on like Virtual Console for Wii. They're emulatable on computers. Like, I mean, any Nintendo game you want,
right,
you can get a ROM of on,
right,
an emulator.
I mean, I'm pretty sure if I pop them inside there, I'd enjoy them. I don't know if I'd really enjoy Super Mario Brothers anymore, but like, you know, Super Mario 3, I could definitely get into. But, mm-hmm. You know, the gaming has really, really changed, not just in terms of graphics, but also in terms of the content. And one of the reasons I started laughing hysterically when I started thinking about Final Fantasy VII was because I remember being 16 or 17, going into my friend's house and seeing him playing Final Fantasy VII, and then all of a sudden, like I said, we grew up on these games in a very, very in a sphere of innocence,
mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden I see Barrett on in one of the cutscenes with his Astrodisc. Exclamation point, question
yeah,
mark.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my God, is he swearing and cussing?
Well, that's one
the
of the
screen. It's like, oh my God, like, you know, the content has just evolved to the point where, you know, you're starting to step into areas that were taboo when you were younger, and now you're into into an environment that's considerably, that can be considerably considered to be more adult than before.
Well,
and like,
see, but
wow.
That's the thing, is like that change, that shift in perspective. Like, we didn't see that as kids, but the guys that were making those games were more adult than we were, and that stuff was there. We just didn't see it. Like in Final Fantasy VII, like there's a whole bunch of like the cross dressing ish thing with Cloud,
right,
and Midgar. There's, you know, Barrett swearing. In Final Fantasy VI, there is, you know, Celis considers killing herself. There's, you know, there's things of suicide. There's issues of suicide, of self identity, like these deeper themes. And back then, you didn't really read that. So that's what I'm saying. Like, when you go back to visit the games, do you get anything new out of them? I mean, of course, like if it's Duck Hunt or Mario, there's not really going to be much there to get, and it's just the old simple gameplay that you like, or the old frustrating gameplay. Like, for instance, I went back to play Castlevania, and god damn, that game is hard. The original Castlevania, like,
yeah, I remember.
That game is hard. But going back to when you play through the games again, those layers of depth that you get when you get perspective at our age. So, like, I don't enjoy Final Fantasy for the graphics anymore. I mean, I do kind of for the pre-rendered backgrounds, but, like, the polygonal stuff's pretty rough to look at now. It doesn't hold up graphically.
Right, right.
I mean, of course, they're redoing it, so we'll get that. But what holds up for me is, like, well, I get more out of it. I see these, you know, layers of character development. And as a kid, you don't see that. And then so you get the benefit of having an aged perspective kind of craft these games, craft their characters. And then that kind of stands the test of time, those character arcs. Whereas, like, that's one of the things about, like, indie developers and the younger generation. Maybe they don't realize that, you know, they are, you know, they pour everything into, like, you know, graphics and stuff like that. But a lot of times it really sells people on games is, you know, awesome gameplay and character development.
I think the...
Because let's be honest, a lot of games on Steam just suck.
Well, this is the way I kind of think about it. I'm not so sure if I necessarily agree with the character development part, because a lot of the games back then were, I guess, really innocent. Like, there wasn't much on story. Like,
what do you mean innocent?
Okay, so let's take a look at this. Do you remember the old Final Fantasy?
Which one?
The number one. Number
the
one.
The old
one.
Yeah.
And the old Dragon Warrior. Like, those old RPGs from Square and Enix. They're Square Enix now, but back then they were, like, two completely separate companies. And Legend of Zelda.
Yeah.
And whatnot. So those games pretty much... I tend to view the old 8-bit era as the era in which we saw old 80s cartoons. They were all about, like, okay, it's good and evil. Like, you will see the old Transformers series. Like, it's they had really, really, I guess, cheesy lines about Autobots versus Decepticons, good mm-hmm. versus evil. It was also
very, very
simplistic. It was very, very. It came from a very, very honest black and white perspective. And Final Fantasy was all about destroying the main bad guy, and so was Legend of Zelda to a degree. It's kind of like kids growing up on fairy tales. Now, fast forward 15 to 20 years later. And from and seeing a game like Final Fantasy or Dragon Warrior evolve into their modern day incarnations, like Final Fantasy IV, mm-hmm. Even Final Fantasy VII, where all of a sudden you now have a game in which you have sympathetic bad guys, bad guys that became evil, but mm-hmm. had shades of gray. They weren't just black,
you don't
and gray,
think
Sephiroth
were,
and
you,
whatnot.
You don't think there were sympathetic bad guys in the NES SNES era?
In the NES and SNES era, I would definitely say there were. I just don't think they were as numerous or even as well done as the ones we have today, because the content is much more adult. It's you tend to explore those in much more vivid detail than back then. And so going back to my Transformers example, a few years ago they came up with a new Transformers series, and they finally finally reunited Peter Cullen, the voice of the original Optimus Prime, and mm-hmm. Frank Welker, the voice of the original Megatron. They made Transformers Prime.
Yeah.
And that show definitely had a lot of kiddie elements.
Does Frank Welker have a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame? Because if he doesn't, he needs one.
I have no idea.
Because he's been the voice of, like, the best characters ever.
I'm not sure, but he's definitely done a lot of incredible voice acting. Why the hell didn't you use him as the voice of Megatron
he's
in
Scooby-Doo.
The Transformers movies?
He's freaking Scooby-Doo, man. Can't argue with that.
I think he did Soundwave and Shockwave on No, he didn't do Shockwave. He did someone else's voice on a variety of voices on Transformers. But going back to my point, if you see the old Transformers series and you compare it to Transformers Prime today, the characters, they have a much smaller cast of characters, but there's more, there are themes that are explored, like about leadership, about the characters are explored in much more depth than there was available back then in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And like I kind of see that as a parallel to how we view video games and how the characters are developed and how the stories are evolving and how they're trying to say something about the world around us rather than saying, oh, there's an evil guy who came down to take over this land. He's cursed the princess. He's killed the king, and now a great virtuous hero must rise up to destroy him. Well, real life is really a lot more complicated than that, and those themes are really brought forth in the newer genre of video games.
Well, let me try to bring up maybe a counter argument to your point.
Sure.
And let's take one of your favorite series, Metal Gear Solid. Oh, yeah. Okay. Uh-huh. So the original Metal Gear, the old Nintendo one, still pretty. The first one, Metal Gear.
Yeah.
Not Metal Gear Solid on PS.
Sure.
Let's look at it this way. Let's take three slices. Let's do Metal Gear Solid for the first one for the PS.
Uh-huh.
And then we'll go to straight to Metal Gear Solid 5.
Right.
Phantom Pain, right?
Yeah.
So we got three windows. And this is the cool thing about, I mean, of course, Kojima, that he has refined his craft through his experience and he's gotten perspective. And, you know, he was a young guy when he started out with this. But, did you play Metal Gear, the original NES one, when you were a kid?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
So was your impression of that something that was kind of like milquetoast, like just good versus evil, or did you find it nuanced back then?
I did not find it nuanced back then.
Now, if you go back as an adult and play it, would you find it, would you be able, do you think you would get more out of it? Would you see more nuance in it? Would you see the layers?
No, because the old 8-bit version... I mean, let me put it this way. The first game was really simplistic. It pretty much just involved Snake just breaking into Outer Heaven to blow up Metal Gear.
Yeah.
And there was definitely a plot twist in which you realize your CO, your commanding officer, Big Boss, is the guy who's been behind your back, who had your back throughout the entire game, mm-hmm. is really the main bad guy.
Yeah.
But his intentions for the idea of him creating a world meant only for soldiers, that was a theme that wasn't brought up in the original Metal Gear game at all. If you played the 8-bit sequel in Japan, Metal Gear 2 Solid Snake, that would have been explored. But in the original Metal Gear game here in the States was pretty much just propped up as another good versus evil kind of duel.
Mm-hmm.
So if I go back and play it now, I mean, because Metal Gear has evolved into this incredible story. It's got so many themes to explore for the gamer. It's got this incredibly complex storyline. Looking back at the original Metal Gear game through those lenses, through that particular bias I have now, then yes, I could say that, you know, looking back on it, I could realize this is the game that started it all. This is the meaning behind it. But was it packaged in a way that implied complexity of plot, of thought, of perspective? No, I don't think so.
Okay. And then, so you would say that then it evolved as it went forward in its complexity. So do you find more value in the newer ones compared to the older ones? Like, if you're going back, like, do you have more fun playing the newer ones versus the older ones? And is that because you're older?
Do I have more fun? Oh, that's an interesting question. Because...
And that's a hard question, because it also begs the question, what is fun to you now? Like, as kids, fun was what? Blowing shit up, seeing crazy effects on the screen.
Well,
but now what's fun to you? Like, do you get more fun out of the complex narrative and the underlying character structures, or do you get more fun out of, you know, freaking pulling up a bazooka and launching into a Metal Gear and trying to blow shit up. It has to be a combination of the two.
I think it's got to be a combination of the two, and here's why. If I could bring up, pop open my Nintendo Control Deck and just play Metal Gear again, the original one, I'm pretty sure I'd enjoy it.
Yeah.
If I pulled up the original Metal Gear Solid and played that, I would enjoy it because of the gameplay.
Yeah.
I love the stories. I love the character development that comes into it. But some of the Metal Gear games, let's face it, they're short on gameplay and it's one huge cutscene,
yeah,
which is something I don't particularly enjoy.
Because you can go overboard
yeah, exactly,
both ways.
Exactly. Like, you know, Xenosaga was guilty of that, the first one.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And Metal Gear probably isn't the best game to use to illustrate this, but I want to go back to Final Fantasy.
Yeah.
I loved the original Final Fantasy game. You go to a town, and you do a lot of farming, you build your character's levels, which was irritating, but like it was...
God, farming in Final I would rather have like 3 or 4 root canals back-to-back than have to farm for that game. Although, I learned later on there's ways to cheat it.
Yeah.
If you go to, like, there's certain places that you can, where there's, like, high level monsters that spawn that you can level you faster.
Right, but
it's still
time
consuming.
Yeah.
But they didn't have back then. I mean, that's another experience. They didn't know they didn't really have the experience of how to perfect grinding yet.
Yeah, exactly. But the thing is, but despite that, you had a variety of items to equip your characters with. You know, what's the best sword, armor, or spells you should equip your people with before you head into a dungeon?
Yeah.
You have a white and black mage that you had to like really beef up to before you could throw them into action against some higher level bosses to support your group.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the gameplay there was fantastic, especially since each character had a unique subset of skills.
Yeah.
Now fast forward 10, 20 years later, and you have Final Fantasy characters who can pretty much like in Final Fantasy VI, you could probably give Ultima to everyone in your group, and I'm like, well, in my opinion, that really took away from it because you know the characters could have brought something very unique to the game, not just in terms of their overall of their particular personalities, like their unique stories that contribute to the overall plot, but it's so much more interesting to play when you realize you have this one character in your group who's got a very very specific skill set that is very useful for this particular situation.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did was, you know what, let's just give everyone everything, and I'm like, well, that takes away from the gameplay a lot because it's like, well.
Well, that is an emblem of emblem of a problem that it plagues, you know, young and older game designers and gaming as well, is that restrictions breed creativity. Like if you have everything available to everybody open all the time, then it's harder to make progress because there's no challenges to overcome. Like, it's when they throw a whole big bunch of money at a game and they give it, like, a bajillion-dollar budget.
Yeah.
And they take extra time with it and they blow it up into, like, a big production and then it actually just kind of sucks and it feels hollow. Whereas, like, a lot of them, the genius is bred when you have these restrictions that you have to, like, figure out creative ways to navigate around. And that's where the real genius comes in, is, like, how do we solve this problem with just... How do we fit tab A into slot B with just duct tape and make it work and make it fantastic. Whereas if you have all more than you need, then you kind of like get a little paralyzed with like what you can use to make it happen. And that happens both in creating games also, and also I think when you're playing them as well. Like if you have, it's a balance that you have to strike. It's like you can't have too many options, but you can't have too few. It's like this delicate line you got to walk. And I think experience, you know, the perspective getting older gives you a great ability to be able to craft that. And I think the younger people maybe don't appreciate that. And then when they go back and play that, they find that sense. Because I remember hitting a bunch of walls and as a kid and feeling like, oh, this kind of sucks. But, and then maybe having too much, like, and then I remember playing Grand Theft Auto for the first time and having the open world. I'm like, oh, there's too much to do. I don't even know what to do. It's just so open. It's too much. But then you kind of learn as you go along how to gauge that experience and craft that perspective into what you're making or what you're playing.
And that's really interesting because, like, we know, like, in today's movies, in today's movie industries, and in today's even television producing arenas, that certain producers have been influenced by other people's art and, like, whatnot. Like, it's undeniable that Star Wars had an influence on science fiction movies, Star Trek, and et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of wondering, how did... I'm wondering if you look very carefully back at back in the old days of 8-bit gaming, how much has what have modern day developers learned from people from back then, like they're in terms
I would like to think, and this you actually bring up a really good point that I want to address, is that the video game industry is very self-referential in a developing sense, in a developer way. Like, they're very aware of what has come before and what they can do going forward. One of the case in point I wanted to make is they even make that apparent to a lot of times when the players, Donkey Kong. Everybody knows Donkey Kong. So Donkey Kong started out in way late '70s, early '80s, on the arcade console, and then he got ported over to home console. It was Super Jumpman. That's where Mario originated. And
no kidding. That's where Mario originated from.
Yeah, Mario was not originally Super Mario. He was Jumpman.
I remember Jumpman on my old Atari computer.
Yeah, because he was going after Donkey Kong, and that was Princess Toadstool up at the top there. That was the origin of it.
Is that really?
Yeah.
Holy crap!
So
I mean,
it's always building on itself. The industry is always building on itself. It's very self-referential, and so one of the things that kind of broke the fourth wall that I actually was shocked at, and that actually was surprised that I actually picked up on as a child, was Donkey Kong Country. So, it was like 1992, 91. Rare Nintendo teamed up to do Donkey Kong Country, which was 32-bit, 3D rendered back, or 2D rendered backgrounds, or pre-rendered backgrounds, like graphical breakthrough. It looks pretty. They're great games. And they breeded a whole line of Donkey Kong Country sequels and games that came afterwards. But one of the characters that was in the game was Cranky Kong. Cranky Kong was like this old kind of rickety monkey, Donkey Kong's progenitor, or the original Donkey Kong, you would say. So he's the one that was from the arcades, and he was instructing the new Donkey Kong on how to do his job. And he would reference, you go see him in the game, he's like, oh, I remember when we didn't have this, and you got these newfangled graphics, and you've got these new things, and we didn't have all that. He's just very like a crotchety old dude in a rocking chair,
right,
reminiscing about the good old days of the 8-bits and the arcade classics and stuff like that. And meanwhile, you got the new Donkey Kong, who's got his 3D rendered backgrounds and his 3D models, and so they've incorporated the progression of the industry into the characters of the game, and use that as a way to not only create interesting character moments and just be really downright funny, but also self-referential, but also kind of highlight, like, it's like, well, we did gain perspective on what worked and what didn't from these original games. We are building on it to move forward, and we do appreciate the value of what came before, even though we know that a lot of times, because of what came before, we didn't have the graphical or programming or design knowledge to make it as enjoyable as it used to be. But if you go back and play it, it's still pretty fun, and even the frustrating parts are fun. And Cranky Kong talks about that as well. He's like, yeah, we had 10 lives to go, one level, one story, and now you have like the whole island to go explore or whatever,
Right.
So all these references, and you can kind of see that evolve in lots of different games. Case in point, another one I wanted to bring up was how Metroid has changed.
Oh.
So the original Metroid, you had just a platformer with like basically no story. It was a platformer, and it was all relying on ambiance.
Yeah, pretty much.
And suggestion. And they kept that. Up until Other M, which was god-awful. But they learned going in, it was like, okay, well, why was Metroid popular? Because there's a bajillion platformers, right? And Metroid was frustrating as hell. It had a ridiculously blame password save feature. There was no map.
You could get lost. It's so easy to... to play that game for hours and have no idea what you're doing.
Yeah, it's ridiculous how frustrating that game can be, but yet it worked because the ambiance, because the music, because the character itself, the model, and what it was doing, and the design was so intricate and interesting. And so they going forward, they worked with that. It's like, well, when they decided to do, they did the Super Nintendo game, and they perfected it in that one.
Yeah.
It took exactly what they did. They added a better save feature. They added maps. They improved upon what was working. And you go back and you play Metroid, and you're like, okay, I see, you know, this game sucks in these ways, but it's awesome these ways, and now it's better. And then so they went into, when they ported over, when Retro Studios got a hold of it to do Metroid Prime, they're like, okay, well, they didn't go ahead and just do whatever they wanted to with a bigger budget and all the huge graphic power. They're like, no, let's go back and look at, you know, let's reference back behind. Let's take our experience as children. What really worked about that game? What did we have fun with? Well, it wasn't the save features. It wasn't the map. It wasn't this and that. It wasn't the story. It wasn't the dialogue. It was what worked. The ambiance, the music, the setting, and the designs of the enemies and the characters. And that's what they really stuck with at the heart of for Metroid Prime. And that's what works. That's why nobody's talking in Metroid Prime.
And I remember how, did you ever play the Metroids for Game Boy?
The Return of Samus?
Yeah, the Return of Samus and one. That was a great game.
Oh, yeah,
Did it come out before the Super Nintendo version or
it
after?
It did. It was Metroid 2, Return of Samus, and then Super Nintendo, Super Metroid.
That game was, I think, the first to really improve on take the operational aspects of Metroid that were great and to really improve on them. Because, Metroid, the original one, the 8-bit one, was, in my opinion, a holdover from the old Atari gaming days. Like there were glitches in the game, and you could, if you knew how to cheat, you could kill the Mother Brain without having to go through the entire game. You use a freeze beam to get the Tori in, and you go in and it would be hard as hell since you didn't have every single one of the items. But if you had enough missiles, you could conceivably kill the Mother Brain and beat the game in a little bit. That game was buggy.
But yeah. Hell.
But they took everything that worked and moved it into Metroid 2, and then they used the same formula for Super Metroid, and I think from that point out they kind of ventured into, you know, first person shooter category with Metroid, and they tried new things, which I think in some cases it was enjoyable, it worked for the player. In some cases it just didn't.
Yeah. Well, and part of that too is just, you know, advents in technology, but I think an important part of having a
but I wonder though, it's like although they've incorporated, they found out a formula which works for a particular game, I wonder if something gets lost in the advent in using more advanced technology and advanced approaches, because
I wholeheartedly agree.
Final Fantasy, going back to Final Fantasy for a second, Final Fantasy VIII was a flop. I everyone had high expectations after VII, and it just flopped.
Well, see, I don't agree. I don't agree. I think so. That it had a mixed reception. I don't think it was technically a flop. I wouldn't say sales reflected that. I would say that it was definitely a different tack. There was a lot of things wrong with it.
Okay,
but musically,
musically it was great.
Musically, yeah. It was great. Graphically, it was on par with what everything was doing at the time.
Uh-huh.
It had great grass, if you didn't know. One of the best grasses in fun. Sorry, I pay attention to that kind of shit. Hair and grass and graphics. The story was, that's another one that you go back and look at the story and there was a whole bunch of stuff I missed that I didn't see that now going back and I play through again.
Right.
Like I get out of it more. You've only played it once through?
No, I played it twice through. And
how old were you?
When did it come out? That was
98, 97?
No, it was a little bit after that. I think I was 20 years old at the time.
Okay.
Yeah. But you know, going after,
I would say give them the shot. Because I went back to about 10 years later.
Well, Final Fantasy IX came out. They pretty much went back to old school Final Fantasy.
Oh, yeah. You
know, and they took what worked in the original. And, you know, that was a Final Fantasy I really, really enjoyed.
I love that game more each time I play it.
Right.
Eight, I don't love more. It's just something that I see more of not, and I'm not necessarily impressed with what I see or like it better for that, but I see more. Especially with like the different interpretation of like maybe Squall's dead for the second half of the game.
Right.
I didn't see that coming. So I'm gonna agree on one point with there and kind of disagree on the other one. Another game I wanted to bring up, of course, is Legend of Zelda, which now they're kind of this new Breath of the Wild coming out. They're kind of going back to the original Legend of Zelda formula, the non-linear, kind of very lightly worded, you know, exploratory version instead of the kind of harshly narrated and directive Skyward Sword and one might say Twilight Princess, but Twilight Princess felt less directed and narrow because Midna, who was your kind of curator through the game, was so entertaining and one of the best characters I think ever in Zelda. But many people think Skyward Sword Fee was just an annoyance that just kind of directed you to do the most inane and meticulous BS.
You see, this is one of the major ironies of our time. I pretty much kept up with, I think I pretty much kept up with some of the major series growing up as a kid. And I remember during Legend of Zelda, how could you not like Legend of Zelda back when you were a kid? Mm-hmm. The original game came out and like everyone was begging for Zelda 2 to be released because everyone loved the original Zelda. And we were all talking about Legend of Zelda. When they come out with the sequel, and Zelda 2 came out, and like, yeah, everyone liked it. But it was a game to try to go in a certain direction and just didn't they tried going a certain way. It just didn't work.
See, that's another thing. I think you should go back and revisit. I think the perspective, that's that aging gamer syndrome. I think that a lot of times we have a first impression as a young person, either for good or bad,
right?
And we are reticent to want to change that. We like to look through those nostalgia glasses and keep that impression in mind. Like, remember the first time I wanted to go back and play 9? I was terrified. I was terrified to go back and play 9 because I had such a good time with it the first time.
Yeah.
That I was afraid that my my older self would not like it as much.
Well, and
then I went back through it and it lived up. And you have to be ready to take that risk to be like, hey, you know what? This might fuck up my perception of the game if I go back and play it again, because I'm changing the age at which and mindset at which I'm engaging with it. But hopefully, if you know it's a good game, it'll hold up. If it's not, you'll see through and understand why. You'll have a deeper understanding of the game, and then hopefully the developers have learned that same lesson. And the people in the industry have learned that same lesson and implemented that moving forward.
Right. Maybe. It's like, yeah, the Nintendo Control Deck has been re-released, hasn't it?
Yeah, they recently, back in, I think it was late 2016, they had that Nintendo USB kind of mini computer that came out that had like 30 or 40 games loaded on there.
I should consider getting that because
you should.
I go on Facebook occasionally. I know someone who broke out his original 8-bit Nintendo Control Deck that he has tucked away for this long period of time, and he just broke it out, cleaned it up, and it works just as well as it did when this guy was a kid. And this guy's pushing 40.
Yeah,
it's like wow, you still have your Nintendo Control Deck, and That system was so enjoyable when I was younger, and I'm thinking, yeah, maybe I should just go back and plug it back into a TV now and go back and enjoy some of those games.
Go back and go. You know, that's the thing is like, you know, it's a hard time for as gamers that have gone for as long as we've been playing. There are so many, the volume of games coming out are so great. There's so many great games that we never played. There's so many great games that we did play that we need to revisit. It's almost overwhelming. And that's another thing that as you get older, you have to really pick and choose and cherry pick which games that you play now because you don't have as much time. Like when we were kids, we had a whole bunch of time. We could play lots of different games. But now it's like, well, I have a limited amount of funds, limited amount of time to invest into my gaming. Like, I really need to want to be sure what I'm playing is worth my time.
And if you want to invest in something that's genuinely a game, or do you want to invest in a storyline? Because nowadays, you know, I don't game nearly as much as I used to. There's one or two games that come out a year that I think that I really, really like.
Let me reassure you, we are in our 30s. There are guys in their 20s. Everybody declines in their gaming as they get older, I would think.
Well,
you have a full-time job, you have family responsibilities, you've got all that stuff. When you're a kid, I had like 6 hours a day to just do nothing.
Right. And yeah, you definitely do decline, but like, you know, I think this is another reason why I don't game as nearly as much as I used to, because I look for a game that just really sucks me in. Metal Gear does that because of its rich storyline and the voice acting. But another game that, you know, I like is that remake they did of Castlevania, the Lords of Shadow series.
Yeah.
Oh man, they really pulled out all the stops for that one in terms of voice acting. They got like what's his name? Robert Carlyle as the lead Belmont character, Natasha McCallone, mm-hmm. Patrick Stewart, Captain Picard.
Yeah.
And they hire these high profile actors and use them to do the voice acting for this game and they took an old 8-bit game that had a really, really simplistic plot and wove it together with this incredibly dark, complex storyline about how someone falls to evil and how someone is able to redeem themselves. And that's what I'm really getting into. And
Took it off an 8-bit base.
They took it off an 8-bit base, exactly. And like, but look at what they're doing with so many of our old childhood cartoons like Transformers. Michael Bay has made a movie series
off of
that.
But we have to be careful. Well, maybe Michael Bay is not the best example, but we have to be really careful not to over-rely on old stuff too. Like, we learn from the old games, the old movies, and we reinvent them and combine them in new and interesting ways, from 8-bit to, you know, modern day, you know, what Kojima did with Metal Gear to Metal Gear Solid 5 all the way up. But we can't rely on that. That's why I'm hoping that new game developers and people that are inventing characters and inventing gameplay and will learn the lessons of the old and the new and kind of make sure they don't fall into the same traps of, like, because there's times when you, like, a game that's been done to death. What's a game that's been done to death that you're sick of?
Final Fantasy. Probably, yeah, because, you know, that's a series I feel like with all due respect to people who've been working on it, that's a series that I don't think they've learned from. The series, of, in my opinion, has gotten progressively worse.
Mm-hmm.
The not just the voice actors, but the quality of the gameplay, the quality of the storyline, depending on your perspective,
it seems formulaic now. It's been done to death.
Yeah, exactly.
Same thing with I just started playing Resident Evil 7. And that series has been going on for upwards of 20 years now, or almost 20 years. And, you know, it got formulaic and it got trite and it changed what it was, what it started out with. And now they went back to formula. So they went back to the formula that worked with the formula that worked with the original graphics. Now they have awesome graphics, but the same formula, because they were getting awesome graphics, but a different formula, it was turning into like an FPS action shooter instead of like survival horror. And it's like, wait, what is Resident Evil really, really about? About survival horror. And they went back to it, and this game is freaking terrifying. So you got to combine the old with the new, and then to the people that are making new survival horror games, you learn what works and what doesn't, and then make sure that you kind of employ those lessons that you have from your perspective, whether you're young or old. To try to make the best games you can, I guess.
Well, occasionally the paradigm shifts work, but like I think they start to fall within a certain context. Like, you're a Castlevania fan, right?
Mm-hmm.
I played the original Castlevania. It's hard as hell. Castlevania 2 was a shift. Castlevania 3 I really enjoyed, but I think when they came out with Symphony of the Night,
mm-hmm.
That game, they took elements of Castlevania that worked, but put them in a context very much like Metroid, and which fans apparently loved.
Mm-hmm.
And so I argue that was a very, very successful paradigm shift.
Yeah.
And, so things evolve. I agree. And like, you know, but I think it's kind of cool to experiment with things from time to time. But like, you know, going back to Final Fantasy, I think a lesson to be learned there is like, you know, it's important not to overdo it, because once you stray way far away from the genre, people are like, oh, this is not Castlevania. Oh, this is not Final Fantasy, and you lose some of the magic.
Yeah, it's a balance between, you know, you don't want to lose your inner child, but you don't want to let him dominate either. I think it's kind of like you have a little kernel of your inner child to guide your creative spirit, and then you let that be you let your experience and age as like a lens to kind of guide your gameplay, guide your creativity, and create or the best content you can, or to use that to have the best gaming experience that you can, really.
Right.
Cool, man. Wow, so many good times. So many good times. Like I said, it's hard to take off those nostalgia glasses, but it's good to revisit those old games. It's good to learn those lessons, and looking forward to, you know, when you're trying to be innovative or looking for new games, new content, that you take the time to experiment with the new, but, you know, revisit the old too.
Yeah.
All right. Well, and let us know what you think about old games, new, your perspective of the aging gamer, whether you are an aged listener or a not so aged listener. We'd love to hear from you. So look us up on facebook.com/nerdfunnel, youtube.com/nerdfunnel, nerdfunnel.com. We are on all of those places. And until next time, game on. You've been nerdfunneled.